The Theosophical Society takes pleasure in introducing Mr. Geoffrey Hodson in the fifth of the series of School of the Divine Wisdom talks. This one is entitled The Starry Body of Man, Its Colors and Their Significance. Mr. Geoffrey Hodson.
Sir Jameson and friends, perhaps I ought first to explain the use in my title and the advertisement of the word starry, the starry body of man. We might well ask ourselves what that could possibly be. Well, the old medieval European theosophists and alchemists and philosophers, they coined a word for this body. They called it the astral body. And this word came to be used right down to the present day and in our literature. Translated literally, it would suggest that this part of man had some specific and special interrelationship with the stars. Astral, do you see? But on looking into the history of the word, one finds that what they meant was a shining body of man, a body of man, a principle of man which is self-radiant, shining, star-like, and so astral, they said. So this is our subject together this evening. And in case there are some new visitors, most welcome this evening, shall I very briefly state a theosophical view concerning man and the place of our subject in that view. Man is said primarily to be a threefold being. This physical body, the spirit indwelling, the identical self, and the connecting intellect. So that man is described as that being in whom highest spirit and lowest matter are united by intellect. A threefold individuality, man, ourselves. But of course, knowing ourselves as we do, we know that we are much more complex than that. And the old sages and philosophers investigating deeply find that we are at least sevenfold. And excuse me for repeating this so many times, but the knowledge is really basic to the understanding of oneself and of the ageless wisdom. What are the seven parts of each one of us, then? Pure spirit, by whatever name we may call it. A vehicle and power of spiritual will. God the Father manifested in and as man. Spiritual wisdom. God the Son manifested in and as the spiritual self of every man. God the Holy Ghost, the spiritual intelligence which makes what is called the higher triad, the immortal self, the reincarnating individuality of every human being. And then, the higher triad, as I just said, undying, immortal, perpetually unfolding, a pilgrim God. Manifested just now, we're all awake in a mental vehicle built of mind stuff, our instrument for concrete thought. An emotional body, our subject tonight, vehicle of the emotions, center of feeling, as we'll see. Then the vital body and container of the vital energy of the physical body, sometimes called the vital body, or the etheric double. And then this, the physical body. A fourfold mortal person, you see. In the Latin meaning of the word, mask, persona. This fourfold being, but a mask, through which the inner triad is forever trying, and largely failing, until very great heights are achieved in evolution to express itself through this mask. The lower quaternary and the higher triad then make up the sevenfold man. When we are awake, we're sevenfold. When we're asleep, we cast off or escape from the physical and the etheric. We're fivefold every night. And when we die also, yes, same thing. The physical and etheric double are discarded, worn out generally. And that leaves the fivefold man. The triple self in the mental and emotional bodies. Briefly, though I hardly need to mention it here, I feel sure now. Why is this immortal, undying identity, this shining spiritual one of each one of us, why imprisoned in this body of death? Answer, for purposes of unfoldment, are the development of innate powers which cannot be brought out of the germinal to the active by any other means. So we're born here for a divine and wondrous purpose. The development of the divine powers, resident, unfolding in each and every one of us. What is the explanation within this field of thought of the inequalities of human experiences, the benefits and the sufferings, which seem to be so chaotic and senseless and meaningless, and all the other differing experiences of human life? Where do they fit into this very ordered concept of man? Very neatly. For this evolutionary procedure through successive lives on earth is governed by an exact law. It occurs under the rule of law. The law which St. Paul defined, you remember, God is not mocked, and whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. Law. Every action produces its own automatic and strictly appropriate reaction. And you and I, all of us here, for instance, we're all here in the state we're in, the sex we're in, the financial, caste, active or inactive system in which we find ourselves of our own making. And as a result, we are growing all the time under a principle of assured long-term justice. Such, very briefly, is the basis for our study this evening. Now then, the astral body of man, shall I use that term? What does it look like? Well, it's built of matter which is finer than the gaseous, and therefore it's normally invisible, except in those moments when people have flash of extrasensory perception, and they see radiance round people and things. But to clairvoyant sight or extrasensory perception, the astral body as a vehicle of man has two parts in the main. It has an exact duplication in finer matter of the physical form, generally called the astral counterpart. It is not exactly like it, because the matter there is vibrating so very much more quickly that there aren't the fine edges that we get here in the physical world. The edges all fade out into radiations. Nevertheless, the general impress, when you see in person astral body, you do see a reproduction of the physical body. Then surrounding and interpenetrating that, there is a great deal of astral matter. And it is in this body that the feelings, the passions, the desires, all the emotions, in fact, arise first and find their expression. So that we might think of the astral body as a bridge, or if you like, a medium of the transmission of experience from the physical mind to the mind itself, which in its turn operates in a still higher vehicle. So the astral body then is a bridge between physical and mental vehicles of man. Where is the astral body? Here. It occupies precisely the same place as the physical. And the physical double, really, the astral double, really is a double of the physical body. So now you see we've come to the principle of interpenetration of denser matter by finer material. And when we understand that, it becomes clear that the different realms of nature are not separated in space, but they exist here and now, all of them, so that investigation of any of them to the very highest, with the appropriate order of vision, does not necessitate any movement in space. Only an opening within ourselves of the senses by means of which these subtler phenomena may be perceived. Well, that's easy enough for us today, isn't it? Because we know that we can set up a radio receiver in a hitherto silent room and all the radio programs to which it's tuned will come through. Radio programs are, as it were, could we say, perhaps omnipresent. And so also with the universe. All is here and now. The highest of all worlds and the highest of divine manifestation in them is here. Just here, and there's no need to move one inch in order to be in the actual presence of the whole universe and its inherent and transcendent deity. The mystics and the yogis tell us you don't have to go anywhere. You have to open your consciousness in order to know and be one with God. So, the astral body of a man, yours and mine, not only permeate the physical body, but extend around it in every direction. And that, yes, that portion of the astral body, which extends beyond the limits of the physical skin, this is termed, as a rule, the astral aura. And this aura of each one of us is ovoid in shape. And in normal people is probably about 3 or 4 times as large as the physical body. So the astral aura, for instance, extends somewhere out to there. Under normal circumstances and conditions of emotional normality and reasonable quietude. Of course, I haven't time to go into it tonight, but explosions and charges and passions and excitements and panics all make a difference, of course, to the appearance of the astral body. That's a separate subject, though I am going in to the colors correlated with these changes in a few minutes. I just want to say again, before I do so, that the central portion of the astral body takes then the exact form of the physical and is quite clearly distinguishable from it, is a radiance which we call the aura. In addition to the colors of the aura, there are certain centers of, how can I describe it, soul or spiritual force in the astral body. They're whirling vortices, and we look at them a little later mentally, and I have brought a picture of them in the astral body to show you. Before we do that, shall we examine, in the light of the findings of generations of trained seers, each checking the findings of their predecessors, perhaps adding a little as more knowledge is gained, to give us a stable and safe statement upon these physical and superphysical subjects. Supposing then we were able to see the aura of a person, we would find it built up almost entirely of swiftly moving colors. Or, by the by, all the matter of the aura is in continual circulation. It differs from the physical body, where the circulation is through it. The three circulations of lymph, blood, and vitality is through the body. But in this case, the superphysical bodies, all the matter circulates freely all the time in health. Well, supposing then we saw this, we would see the form, the physical, recognizable physical form, and for a yard or more, on all sides, this ovoid, highly colored aura. Colored, I suppose, because the finer matter, finer than the gaseous, is self-radiant and self-lighted. So these colors aren't reflected colors. They are interior radiances, you see. Now, what colors would we see? I'll just go through them for you and suggest, and remember, there are no dogmas in our studies of theosophy, but we do use, and if we like, test for ourselves the findings of the great teachers. And they tell us this. We'll take the reds first, shall we? Deep red flashes on a dark ground, anger. When we lose our temper, the whole aura can become suffused with this deep red. And out of it, towards the person who has aroused our anger, these flashes can shoot out. Like, almost, yes, almost like daggers. And very, very harmful they can be. And I'll pause here to say, and I won't have to repeat it, that all these emotions by which we are moved are highly contagious. And we're affecting each other all the time. And also, may I add, something which I feel to be so very important, children are very susceptible to the auric forces in the adults around with whom they live. And it is very important for parents and teachers to see that the radiations from their bodies and auras should be harmonious, constructive, and never destructive, as anger, irritability, passion, and the other emotions can be. So, morality apart, and I'm not presuming to preach, it's not necessary if you know the doctrine, for the sake of the health and well-being of other people, it's advisable to control one's thoughts and feelings. National trays, you know, get built up in nations by this continual interaction of the mental and astral aura and forces until you get a kind of peculiar likeness amongst all the people, especially of a well-established nation. Well, that theosophically is explained by this very interaction of which I'm speaking, digressing as I did a little. Then scarlet clouds and flecks on the edge of the aura, irritability. Not so serious, perhaps. Small irritations, and even larger ones. And they show, yes, like little flashes. Small, like snowflakes in red, really, on the edge of the aura. And they intend soon to die out, though they leave, every emotion leaves a mark behind it, as a result of which it's easier, with less force, to exhibit the same emotion again, good, bad, or indifference, different. Now, in this field of red, there can, of course, be brilliant, there can be a noble indignation, permissible, when right-minded and right-directed, valuable, doubtless. Well, what does that look like? Well, that is a noble indignation, righteous, what I nearly said rage, I mustn't say rage, rightless annoyance. That is brilliant scarlet on the ordinary background of the aura. But you know, the lurid and sanguinary red, a kind of unmistakable, very ugly, deep brick red it is, has the color of sensuality. And it's generally right across the middle of the astral body. Now we leave that particular group of colors, brown gray, one of the commonest, dull, hard brown gray, selfishness, self-centered thinking, the preoccupation with self, the desire to present, dramatize, and make a great deal of oneself, and in addition to be so very much, not unnaturally, who's criticizing, concerned with oneself. Brown-gray, brown-red, almost rust color, avarice. And it's a curious thing about this deeply seated avarice in people. It gradually arranges itself in parallel bars across the astral body of a dull rust color. So you might, if you like, say that the miser is self-imprisoned in bars of his own creating. Greenish brown, lit up by deep red or scarlet flashes, jealousy. Yes, it's curious, isn't it, how these folk sayings, how near they come to the truth. The green eye of jealousy. It is green. It's one of the most difficult of all emotions, one of the great disturbers of peace and happiness. Well, greenish brown is seen, lit up by deep red or scarlet flashes. And often, when someone is very much in love with the colour, beautiful colours of love, there may in some natures be also an admixture of these colours of jealousy. Green, really, with flashes of red, particularly when the emotion becomes active. Grey. Well, if you see a heavy leaden grey in the aura of a person, they're suffering from depression. Probably deep grief, sorrow. If you're not careful, this can ooze out over you or enfold you, and you begin to feel depressed yourself. It's necessary not only for self-protection to be very positive then, but in order to be helpful. Fill yourself up with happiness and invoke the power of the will down and try and dispel the whole cloud of grey from the aura of the other person. And if you're practiced at this, you can clean it out in a very short time. Then the person will say, it's a peculiar thing, whenever anybody so-and-so calls upon me, I always feel so much better. But you and I, we can all do that, you know. Even just be positive ourselves. Not egotistically so. And invoke the highest we can upon the person who generally has a very tragic reason for their depression and their grief. A livid grey, quite a slightly different colour, it's almost a hideous and frightful grey. It's the colour of fear. And when that's in the aura, it's very contagious. And it's from the spreading of this that panic can arise. One person gets panic-stricken, the next one, two of them, picks it up, and before long a whole crowd can almost lose their reason, swept along by the tremendous force of human emotion, which of course grows every time it's picked up and sent on, do you see? Well, if you watch that, you'd see it all like great, livid, grey force and clouds enveloping and oozing out of the people. Now, rose colour, unselfish love. And when it is really exceptionally brilliant and tinged perhaps with lilac and is in the upper part of the aura, by the by, then it's spiritual love for all human beings. Now we come to the yellows. Orange, for example, pride and ambition, sometimes found in conjunction with irritability. Orange, then, proud of oneself, you see, and very ambitious. No criticism, merely a detached study. Yellow, all the activities of the intellect. They're all yellow. They all show themselves as yellow in and around the head. This varies from a deep, dull tint through brilliant gold to clear and luminous lemon yellow and primrose yellow, should you say, according to the type of intellect and, yes, of intellectual activity at the time. Then there's a dull yellow sound in the aura too, yellow ochre. This means that the intellect is also being directed to selfish purposes. The yellow has lost its translucence, you see, because the brown of selfishness is mixed therein. Primrose yellow denotes intellect devoted to spiritual ends. Meditation, for example, on the highest spiritual and metaphysical truths, and reaching up to the realization by the higher intellect of oneness with all that lives and with the great Lord of life itself. That is a brilliant primrose yellow. Then sometimes in people's aura, particularly under such conditions, there can be a beautiful golden halo over them. Pure intellect applied to philosophy, mathematics, the highest use of the intellect, and open to the function of the intuition. Gold in the aura, again in the upper portion, generally implies such a character and such activities. Green in general, of course, there are so many shades that it's very difficult correctly to read the significance of the color. And green particularly needs to be interpreted carefully. Mostly, green indicates adaptability. Person with a lot of green in their aura. Third ray people, those of you who are students, have a good deal of green in their causal aura and in their mento-astral aura as well. Grey-green, deceit, cunning. Emerald-green, versatility, ingenuity and resourcefulness. If it's a pure emerald, then all of those qualities will be used, designed to be used, unselfishly. And then there is a very lovely colour, a pale, luminous, blue or leaf green. Deep sympathy, compassion, with the power, yes, because green is an adaptability color, with the power of perfect adaptability, perhaps to choose the remedy or the immediate action for that pain which is causing the compassionate feeling. It's a beautiful leaf green. It's generally across this part of the aura. Bright apple green. That generally accompanies strong vitality, joyous vitality. Apple green. Now the blues. Well, dark, clear blue. Religious feeling. Again, generally in the upper portion of the aura. It's liable to be tinted by many other qualities, thus becoming almost any shade, from indigo or a rich deep violet to a muddy grey blue. In general, blue is the colour of, in the aura, when a person is performing their devotions, and it remains in the aura of devotional people. It's a very beautiful, pure blue. But of course, yes, if our religion has in it the threat, shall we say, of damnation if we're not conforming to the particular religious concepts and ideals, and we're threatened with some dreadful disaster, and we're being worshipful and devoted out of fear, then grey will spoil, will mar the beauty of the clear blue. Light blue, devotion to a noble spiritual cause, and there may be violet, yes, in the very uppermost part of the aura. Idealism and lofty devotion. Sometimes you will find a luminous lilac blue accompanied by sparkling stars in very devotional and highly spiritual people. Their upper auras are glowing and shining and scintillating with this deep and beautiful colored blue and the flashes and star-like upshootings. Joy shows itself in a general brightening and radiance of both the mental and the astral bodies, and in a peculiar rippling of the surface of both, of the auras of both bodies. And cheerfulness generally shows itself in a modified bubbling form. And this settles down, of course, when it's displaced by a steady serenity. Time is driving me on, but I do want to say, to talk about two more subjects. One, the functions of the astral body, which are three, by the by. One, to make sensation possible. There is a built-in inherent attribute of the matter of the astral plane and bodies, which, in a body, bestows upon it the possibility of feeling. In Sanskrit, K-A-M-A. So one function, to make sensation, feeling possible. Another I've mentioned, haven't I? To serve as a bridge between the body and the mind and the inner self. And the third one, to act as an independent vehicle of consciousness and even action. This is very interesting, this is. I have time, perhaps, just a glance at the topic with you. Even during ordinary waking consciousness, that is to say, when we're awake as we are now, it's not impossible that the powers and faculties of the astral senses can be wide awake. Sometimes they bestow astral vision upon us, and we see the aura of someone before us or behind us. Some of these powers correspond to the senses and powers of action possessed by the physical body. And in the person who is trained in all this and meditates regularly and, as we say, tries to live the higher life, this faculty of functioning in the astral body, whilst awake physically, gradually develops. So a kind of ability to be aware and active at two levels is a possibility. Then, of course, when the body sleeps or is entranced, then it's possible for the astral body to separate itself from the physical body and move about and function freely on its own plane. And you and I, all of us, in varying degrees, you know, we have our sleep life. It's only the body which sleeps, friend. This. It's built of cells, you see. And these grow fatigue, need rest, recuperation, and so on. None of the other bodies do. So that as soon as the physical, we fall asleep, as we say, actually the inner ego with its mental and emotional bodies is out of the body. And according to the degree of development, knows so, and can move about and travel about the world, meet friends, be active according to the powers as far as they are yet developed. Very fascinating and wonderful part of this teaching. It includes the lofty ideal of, how shall I put it, of carrying one's longing to serve and help throughout the 24 hours. So that when the body goes to sleep, the person, I suppose, will determine, as soon as I'm free of my body, I will go and help so and so and so and so and so and so. And there is said to be a highly organized system of such helping in the superphysical worlds. As, for example, when hundreds or thousands or a few are sent suddenly out of their bodies in catastrophes, unaware, shocked, profoundly needing help, or other cases, then someone who's wide awake and in possession of the full powers in their subtle bodies, they can be of tremendous help, steadying, explaining, cheering, perhaps transporting them to another more peaceful area of the astral plane, you see. And this is going on, friends, all the time. It's open to all of us. And especially to anyone in whose heart the spark of love for their fellow men and the will to serve and help is really becoming a glowing flame, well, you may be perfectly certain that the moment you fall asleep, you immediately follow the impulse of your life, do you see? Whether at the astral level, the mental level, or still higher. And so it is possible to develop the powers of the astral body so that a man may consciously and deliberately, at any time that he chooses, leave the physical body and pass with unbroken consciousness into the astral body. And the regular practice of yoga, wisely followed with discrimination, can lead to this achievement. And as I've said, just to round off, at the death of the physical body, then the ego withdraws from physical and etheric, and they disintegrate here in this world, and the ego is then free, wonderfully and marvelously free, in bodies which are buoyant, self-luminous, self-moved by thought power and marvelously responsive to the mind. It's only the body dies, friends, not the self, which is immortal and undying. I love that part of the teaching of theosophy. That's why I often repeat it, if you'll bear with me. For us, there is no such thing as death, you and I. We are immortal, undying, shining, radiant gods in the becoming. Each of us. It's only this which shuts us in so heavily, and only this which dies. And by living a clean, pure life, and by becoming a servant of one's fellow men, and by practicing devotion to the highest, we gradually acquire the power of overcoming the limitations of the body and shining forth ever increasingly with the powers of the spirit which we are. Now last, I'm a little over time, if you'll bear with me, just a word about the senses in the astral body. In the astral body and aura, there's nothing really which corresponds to our five sense organs. You can see them, but they're not used. I'll show you a picture in a minute. There are actually seven force centers, centers of soul energy, whirling funnel-like vortices in the etheric, astral, and mental bodies. They perform many functions, one of them which might be thought of as sensory. Where are they? Well, I'll just name them for you, place them for you, then show you the picture and must close. There are seven. One at the base of the spine, sometimes called the root chakra, or sometimes the sacral chakra. Next, one associated somewhat with the spleen. Next, one at the solar plexus, pointing forward here. Another at the heart, 12 spokes, as it were, a whirling, wondrous wheel, chiefly gold and yellow. Another at the throat, blue almost entirely, the blue lotus it's called. Because these look so much like living flowers that the old, old traditions, especially in the East, call them lotuses. But the real Sanskrit word for them is chakram, meaning wheel. Yeah, they look like wheels. Yes, here in the throat, the blue lotus. Here, the brow. And finally, the seventh, at the crown of the head. And as a person's evolution proceeds, and as they succeed in their inner devotion and spirit, devotional and spiritual life, so a fire comes into activity in the body, flows down and activates these chakras, and makes the person out of the body a most radiant and glorious sight.
Mr. Hodson now answers written questions sent up to him from the audience.
Came up, friends, was, if one is already a vegetarian, may I pause there and say there is no relationship whatever between membership of the Theosophical Society and vegetarianism or any other dietetic control. We are all in this society entirely free in the conduct of our lives. Society for the spreading of wisdom, leaving those who study wisdom to apply it each in their own way. Evidently, here is someone, member or not, who says, if one is already a vegetarian and working in the service of his fellow men, with daily meditation and constant thought on what is good, then what remains if we are to take the gates of heaven by storm? Thank you. Splendid question. Two things. The will, the fiery will to go on more and more and more until fatigue, depression, and all those negatives vanish forever, and you become a shining pillar of light here in this world. Never mind about the others for the time being. That's one thing that happens. The power to go on, the will to go on, until there is no other path at all to go, as the Hindu scripture puts it. And what else happens, friends? Ah, the great wonder. The spiritual teacher is found. No one can go on living like that for very long without attracting the attention of one or other of the great sages who have the whole of humanity in their care, shepherds of souls as they are. And they're ever watching for such as these, and no one ever goes unperceived or unhelped. And the lamp of their enthusiasm is fed until it grows, and eventually, either physically or in this body, they will find themselves face to face with the spiritual teacher who is awaiting every one of us. And then a wonderful meeting will occur. And the Master will then know all this, have watched and loved the pilgrim soul, not only in this life, but probably for several lives. And now asks, are you willing and ready to attempt the steeper levels of the path and serve humanity under my direction? And make the necessary efforts and sacrifices. And if the person assents, never being forced to do so, then a very intimate inter-association is established. The person becomes a disciple of the Master, and thereafter is an outpost for his consciousness here in this physical world of ours, and a channel for his blessing, often without her or him knowing it at all. And the wondrous life of discipleship, which becomes increasingly conscious and therefore increasingly wonderful, is entered upon. That is awaiting in answer to this question. It's never forced, and apparently everyone doesn't assent. That's strange, isn't it? But you remember, I've talked about it before, but we might look at it again. It's illuminating. The rich young ruler. He was like this. And he actually came into the presence of the Lord and recognized him, saying, "Master, good Master, please tell me how I may attain unto eternal life." And the Lord looked at him, doubtless saw to the very depths of his being, and said, "Oh, well, keep the commandments. All this I've done from my youth up. I know there's something more to finding life eternal. Please tell me." Then came the acid test. Possessionlessness. "Sell all that thou hast and give to the poor, and take up thy cross and follow me." The eternal rules. And the next very sad verse: "And he turned sorrowfully away, for he was of great possessions." Not a final failure. He'd probably go home and think about it. And if he found himself able at last to regard his wealth as if he were only its steward and not its tight possessor, well, then he would be ready. Use his wealth, then go to the master and say, "I'm ready now," and would be received. And if not in the same life, then in another, for there is no such thing as failure, especially when the lamp is lit and the spark of idealism becomes a fire and a flame in a person's life and heart and aura. Then the gates of the kingdom of heaven can be taken by storm. I have been told, Mr. Hodgson, by a member of the Theosophical Society, that you do occult research under hypnotic trance. It's a dreadful thing to say. Who said that, I wonder? Having regularly attended your school and heard your teaching, I cannot think this is true. Will you please tell me if it is so? I cannot imagine you submitting your will to another. Thank you. It's an absolute falsehood. May I therefore absolutely say so here and now and deny that possibility? Any kind of occult research, even the tiny little bit that I've attempted, demands not putting your mind into a trance, the very opposite. The heightening of all your powers of sight and will and thought and penetrative vision in order to pass through the veil of matter to the deeper levels within. So no, my friend, no. Definitely never. How or why is it we have no memory of our former lives to help us? The memory of all that's happened in this life can be too much for some of us, can't it? By the time we get on a few years, particularly those of us who've lived through two world wars and taken part in one of them, with all that that means, and all the other tragedies and efforts and frustrations, as well as the joys. Now, I believe the answer is that it is a merciful dispensation of providence that the memory of former lives is not allowed to come through into the new brain, which is the seat of memory, lest it would be so full up and preoccupied with the past that it couldn't take in anything new or engage in any new activities, to be lost in the maze of the bewildering experiences of former lives. So my answer to that is, by a merciful dispensation of providence. Yes, perhaps I might add a word. I think this, perhaps, that as soon as it would be helpful to us in the living of our lives, in the facing of our problems, in doing our work in the world as good citizens, and especially as soon as it would be helpful in the great quest, then the knowledge is granted. And I believe little by little, perhaps one former life, which is the key to the experiences of this one, you see. And then gradually, the whole great panorama will be seen. It's one of the most difficult of all forms of occult research. And I'm afraid there are those who do it rather glibly. I would rather warn against that kind of easy-going penetration into what really is a most profound mystery. In the light of the spiritual progress of man, what is your opinion of transplanting of physical organs such as the heart? Without going into any detail, just a broad answer, please remember that the heart is just a pump, and nothing but a pump. Don't endow it with all sorts of wonders. Hasn't any. Just a marvellous pump, that's all. And it pumps the blood through the body. Full stop. Take it out and get a better one. All right, doesn't hurt you psychologically or anything like that. Those wonderful chakras aren't affected at all. Take the chakram at the heart there. When you take a person's heart out, or the spleen out, you don't take the chakram away, it remains. So that all the functioning of the ego through these superphysical parts of consciousness, they're not affected at all, not at all. I'm not dealing with the morality of it or anything like that. I expect you want an occult reference. Well, that's as far as I've gone in my own thinking. It is said in Raja Yoga that the astral body is situated in the head, and then it's said wrong, that's all. Dismiss that, friends. So, yeah, there it is. But we know that it permeates the whole physical body. Could you explain what is meant? Yes, an error is meant. Empty sheet, friend. Anything to add? How is the permanent physical atom transported round the physical world from one body to the next new body at birth? It is attached to the monad by a silver thread, as I've shown you in that chart, which I failed to bring tonight. If you will think of a triangle, shall we say, apex at the ceiling of this hall, two angles of the base at the two walls, see? And those, the base itself representing the whole physical world. See? Now, it's quite a long way from one angle to the other, granted, but the monad is, as it were, the apex of the triangle, and in that sense has all available to it. Everything is here to the monad. So the monad lets down or projects a ray of its power and its life and its consciousness through the planes of nature, yes, to the astral and physical. Place has no significance in this matter. And at each level, a member of the angelic hosts attaches one atom of that plane, and that remains there throughout the series of rebirths, and is therefore called the permanent atom. Motion from there to there really makes very little difference at the higher levels of consciousness. So what seems to be a difficulty geographically down here is not really so. And in any case, the whole procedure is guarded and guided by members of the angelic hosts. A matter into which I can't go any further just now. But in answer to this question, may I suggest that you read that wonderful book, A Study in Consciousness, by Dr. Annie Besant. It is understood that every soul must reincarnate in order to work out previous karma. Oh, don't say that, friends. Reincarnates in order to unfold the innate spiritual powers. That's the purpose, the only purpose. The working out of karma happens to go on at the same time, but don't say purpose. The purpose is growth. Jacob Burma put it wonderfully. The purpose of God is growth. In Hinduism, the supreme deity is called Brahma, which in Sanskrit means to breathe out, to expand. Brahma. We are all monadically Brahmas. And a wonderful procedure of the development from the germinal to the increasingly active of our inherent divine potencies is the real purpose of reincarnation. The other's incidental, friends. How do you explain a rapid increase in the population? Well, there are millions upon millions more monads out of incarnation than ever there are in. So there's no shortage of monads, and so there's no difficulty in a temporary increase of the physical population at a certain epoch.